Hello and welcome to your latest instalment of Scoreheads, a podcast brought to you by the folks behind We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod that celebrates the wholesome and unrelenting love of soundtracks. Yes, that's right, it is time for your regular fix of behind-the-scenes insights as told to us by the fantastic folks that make the notes that emote that can be found in the music of all your favourite films, TV shows and video games as we sit down with composers of scores for all kinds of visual media to find out more about just how they make the magic that they do. I'm John Brown, host of the Composer Series, co-host of We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod, and film correspondent for Express FM. Sean, who are you?
How do I follow all of that? I'm me. This is a philosophical answer. So I am Bristol-based film and soundtrack journalist and the author of the book The Sound of Cinema. Yes, among other things. So,
by the book, it's incredible.
Thank you.
How are you, mate? How are you? Let's get to that. How's your week been? And how's your week in soundtracks been? Anything that's got your ear? Anything that's got, well, any earworms? Anything we need to know about?
Yeah, there's been a few actually lately. It's interesting. We're now at the end of the first quarter. As we record this, we're at the end of the first quarter of the year. So my thoughts naturally lean towards, well, what are going to be my favourite scores come the halfway point of the year? So I'm already kind of assembling that in my head at the moment. I have listened to a couple of really lovely scores lately. Daniel Hart's work for Peter Pan and Wendy, the Disney Plus movie, which is really lovely. His latest collaboration with David Lowery, that's really nice. Chris Bowers and Michael Abel's work on Chevalier, which is out in the UK in June, which the movie adapts the true story of Joseph de Boulogne. So he was a musician in, I believe it was 18th century France, a violinist, a person of colour, who history had seemingly had, you know, he'd been brushed out of the history books, basically. And this story brings him back to the forefront as played by Kelvin Harrison Jr. And Chris and Michael's work is very, very interesting. So and it adapts Bologna's existing works as well. So, yeah, it's a fertile period at the moment for scores, I think.
Just to add to that as well, I've spoken with Kelvin in the past. He's a lovely, lovely guy.
He's great.
And also Chris Bowers. I know you're looking into Chris Bowers, so we will say on the record that we're looking into Chris coming back, hopefully. I'm also looking into a bit of news for you. I'm looking into speaking with Michael as well. So hopefully either one of those magnificent composers will be joining us on the show very soon. Fingers crossed. We'll keep you posted on that.
Michael's great. I've spoken to Michael twice before for Get Out and for Us. He's terrific. He's always got such great insights. So yeah,
wonderful
for that one.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful guy. They're both brilliant. I love their work and I love them as people as well. So yeah, that keep your ears on that. We'll get that coming up. I'm just thinking that what we've listened to that we can talk about. There's one or two things that we've heard that we can't talk about yet, so we'll keep posted on that. One of those is a contender for score of the year, by the way. But we'll more on that in coming weeks. More on that as we go along. You have to keep listening, see? That's how it goes. Anyway, on to this week. For this latest show, we're headed back to a galaxy far, far away. Sean and I are very excited to hit light speed at full throttle and head back to the Star Wars universe as we celebrate the launch this weekend of Star Wars Jedi Survivor. So at the time of recording, it is the launch weekend of Star Wars Jedi Survivor, the exciting new video game from developers and publishers such as Lucasfilm, Respawn and Electronic Arts. So far, it's been a huge hit with both gamers and critics alike. With that, of course, comes a return to form from Star Wars game scoring regulars Gordy Hab and Stephen Barton, who resumed music duties from the previous game, Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order. And my word, have they completely outdone themselves with this score. Sean, tell us a little bit more about this week's guests, if you can, please.
Well, so it's a beast of an album. I mean, what we listened to, there were 4 hours worth of it, so I had to spread it over several evenings, and I believe you did as well. So
I did it all in a day. I did it all because I was just captivated by it. I intended to put it on for an hour, and I ended up doing all 4 hours in an afternoon because I was just completely engrossed in it.
Yeah, it's a very, very intense, very layered, very, very detailed piece of work for the new open world game, Star Wars Jedi Survivor, as we've said, tracing the arc of Cal Kestis, who returns to this game following the previous game, Fallen Order. And we spoke to Gordy and Stephen about the how to create an overarching musical backbone for this character and what happens through his musical interpretation, and how does that influence the player? How does that allude to what's coming up later in the game? We talk a lot about the artistry of video games. Again, this seems to be a running thread throughout the podcast, but yeah. So it's a superb chat, and both guys were really engaged and very funny. There's when we get into the improvisation that was done for the Star Wars Jedi Survivor score, that is, I love that bit. Oh, I'm not going to say anything here. People will have to listen to the interview.
At some point, so you will see this on social media. If you're hearing this, you'll probably have seen it by the time you hear this, but I will at some point post a Scoreheads podcast spoiler without context, and it will just be a picture of Blue Tack.
Say no more.
You'll know. Yeah. You'll know any minute. Yeah. I mean, we've been very fortunate. We did have the score for a, very, very fortunate to have the score for a number of weeks actually before we spoke to them. So we had time to let it resonate. It has resonated with me certainly. It's an epic score, real thrilling, outstanding return to the Star Wars universe on both counts. I think Sean and I sat down with this week's guests, Gordy Hab and Stephen Barton, for around an hour, I think, or thereabouts, yeah, to do some exploration of our own. Here's what they had to say about their exceptional work on the game's music on this, your latest episode of Scoreheads.
It's been a long 5 years. Tried to resist. Fear and mistrust rule the galaxy.
Cal, look into the fire. It will warm you, keep you company. But left unchecked, it will consume everything until there is only ash.
It is both an honour and a privilege now for Sean and I to return to a galaxy far, far away with the two maestros responsible for the quite frankly amazing music you're hearing in the latest game. We are, of course, talking about Star Wars Jedi Survivor. It's a huge, huge, huge game that drops today on all your favourite gaming platforms. Please welcome to the show Gordy Hab and Stephen Barton. Guys, welcome. How are you?
Thanks. Great. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for joining us. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. I'm very excited to hear it in context in the game, but it's no secret how energized we all are about it. My question is, after a couple of years of work on it for you both, how hyped are you two for this game to finally be released into the world? Gordy, we'll start with you, then Steven.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm very excited. This has been a labor of love for both Steven and I, and quite a bit of work. There's quite a lot of music in the game. We had the privilege of recording it with seriously the best musicians on the planet. You know, every inch of it is highest production value. So we're very proud of it, and we're really excited for the world to get to hear it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of an amazing ride from a couple of years ago, and sort of even, you know, this was the first score we really started during the pandemic, and so to be here at the end of it when at one point we were sort of even figuring out, well, are we going to even be able to record any of this, and what's the world going to look like is amazing. So it's fascinating the things that I don't think we ever thought we might do, and we were able to manage to achieve with it. So yeah, just very, very proud of it.
There's a staggering amount of music in the game. I mean, how long did the overall process take, actually getting the music down with the musicians?
29 days. 29 literally days. 29 days, full days at Abbey Road. studios, just recording, because it's just shy of 8 hours. It's around about the 8 hour mark, depending on some a couple of alternates things that we have, but which is a really gargantuan, you know, it's like five or six feature film scores back to back. But you know, I mean, and really, we should give a huge amount of sort of kudos and thanks to Steve Schnurr and EA Music on this, because it's like it's one of those things where you're reflecting back on it. If 10 years ago you'd said we'd record 8 hours of music for a video game with live orchestra, I think people would have laughed at you. Firstly, how? Secondly, like, how can that possibly be the case? So yeah, kind of an amazing thing, really.
But, it really is. Here we are. It's a labor of love for Steve as well. You know, I mean, I think he really put everything behind this thing because he believes in Steven and I and the music we were writing. So thanks to him for having our backs on everything and letting us really play in the sandbox, so to speak.
It's also the fact that with the size of these games now, and you know, as they get bigger and bigger, and you know, I think, you know, the full campaign on this thing, if you really do a lot of the side content, I mean, it can be 30 plus hours. And so as these things grow, there would be two ways you could have really gone about it. You could have said, oh, we're just going to, like, you know, write a couple hours of music and loop the living hell out of it. And I could see how that might be a valid thing, you know, that's okay. But to sort of go back for it and say, like, actually, no, I think we should do this, and I think it should be at the quality level, you know, there shouldn't be any unloved children and sequences with music or less good production value, is kind of amazing, really. And that's games have become the greatest canvas to play on, kind of, in the entire media music industry. I mean, it's like because of these things that we can do, where on any other project you'd be either laughed out of the room or just, you know, I mean, no one's probably going to make an 8 hour film anytime soon, or maybe they will, I don't know. Who knows?
I love about this and Fallen Order, actually, is that, and with all the work you guys do, really, within the Star Wars realm, but the level of detail and the level of attention and care that's gone into this is incredible. There is no copy and paste here. Every single moment, every single minute is uniquely crafted to that moment within the game. How important was that to you to make that so? But also, how challenging was that, making sure that, and how exciting, I guess, was it, making sure that every single second was uniquely crafted?
I think it was vital. We really approached this as though we were scoring a film. I mean, it's narrative, it's a story, there's character arc. We needed to make sure that the music accompanied that. And so we approached it just like we were scoring, well, quite literally a 30-hour movie, I guess, if you want to look at it that way. You know, so, I mean, I think every moment was bespoke and needed music that was bespoke. So in order to really carry the narrative, it was just vitally important that we approach it that way. And also, you know, make sure that each moment that we're sort of crafting and scoring is unique, carries sort of our aesthetic, fits the universe, and most importantly, fits the story, because that's at the end of the day the most important thing. I mean, we're storytellers at the end of the day, and this story, in my opinion, is one of the greatest told in this franchise, and you know, it deserved a score.
Yeah, it's interesting because, Steve, you said there that you're not looping endless bits of music. So presumably, this being an open world game, like, the idea is that is the score designed to kind of go organically wherever the player kind of goes, and does it kind of build out from there?
Yes, to a degree. So basically, we obviously have a large, there's quite a lot of cinematics. So there are sequences where we do have sort of on rails where we know exactly what the timing is going to be. And so that obviously, that's one sort of known quantity. But one of the things we did with this one is we have some systemic music systems that are able to, for example, if you're doing retraversal, so maybe when you get to a particular area, we have lots of pieces of explore music, for example, that we might use, and lots of pieces of combat music that we might use. So it's not that you wouldn't necessarily never hear the same piece twice. You may. The idea, though, is that you never notice it. You never notice, that's the same thing. And one of the ways we did that, for example, is in combat tends to be in short melees. And this is one of the nice things that we get with these kinds of games, is that often, you know, you very rarely have to mow through 3,000 stormtroopers in one after, you know, one after the next for 20 minutes. There are moments where you have, like, massive odds against, you know, to fight against science, and that's great. But we often have quite little short bursts of sort of 3-4 animes. And so one of the things we worked on was like trying to write some music that we could sort of dip in and out of as we needed, and dip in and out of different bits of it. So you might hear, let's say you have two combat encounters in a very short space of time, you might hear different pieces of the same music, or a different chunk or a different section, and with a very natural end, and the game very intelligently understands how to switch, and for example, like, we don't also want to play massive boss music when you come around and there's one stormtrooper. You know, there's gradations of intensity, so that's one of the challenges there. So
I just want to talk to you guys about, obviously, there are a lot of different story threads, as you say. There's lots of arcs, lots of multiple paths one can take, and so forth, and a lot of characters, of course. And in particular, when writing for characters and their themes and motifs, what drives your creative process, guys? Do you try and get inside the characters' heads a little bit to decide what their themes should sound like? How does it all work? Stephen, we'll start with you, then Gordy, please.
It's sort of perspective, actually. It's because it's funny. Sometimes you want to view something from the character's perspective and get in their heads, and sometimes you want to sort of view it from an external perspective. And towards, you know, obviously not going to spoil anything, but towards the end of the game, that becomes very important. And that the idea of who and why and what you sympathize with. I think that's what's really interesting about this game, is it's darker. It's very much Our Empire Strikes Back, and it really asks those questions. It says, like, who's right here? Like, maybe we're not sure who's right. And so that's, I think, interesting.
Gordy? Yeah, I mean, along the same lines, I mean, I think that when you're scoring a character in a film or a game or whatever it may be, you know, you really want to take into consideration the point of view of the character. I guess it's perspective, sort of the same way of saying it. But, you know, whenever I'm writing a theme for a character, I'm really kind of trying to see that world through the eyes of that character. And so then I think the theme with those sort of parameters in mind. With something like this, where it's a very long story and there's quite a bit of arc, and characters change and develop, the music needs to sort of follow that same guideline. So, you know, you might have a theme that you heard in Fallen Order that you'll hear in Survivor, but it's changed, it's evolved, and it's continuously evolving. So that's a really fun process as well. It's like, it's, in a way, the themes themselves have a similar arc as the characters themselves, and that's kind of a fun sort of angle to play on it musically.
Well, yeah, because Gordy, like you're saying there, when you've got a character theme and you're building on it, would it be right in saying that the Cal Kestis theme, is that extrapolated from the previous game and developed in this game? Is that like the backbone of the whole thing?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, the Cal Kestis theme is strong and alive in this game as well, and has taken on a new life in many ways.
He's also very much in a different place. I mean, Cal, we find him in this game, is sort of, you know, it's a number of years down the line, and things aren't maybe going so well, you know. And that's one of the, I think, the interesting things about this is like, the first game had a sort of a very cheerful sort of optimism throughout, and was very much like, you know, had, you know, with very, very dark sort of undertones. Obviously, the Jedi have lost. It's pretty much it's about as low as we go. But I think there was very much a sort of sense of like, right, onwards. And I think what's interesting about this one is, as you come to a place where you're finding like, well, we sort of all know where this is going. We know he doesn't manage to rebuild the Jedi Order in between him and now and the beginning of Episode 4. We know that doesn't happen. And so there's an interesting thing between our audience perspective and Cal's perspective. And so I think very much this time it's a much bigger story and the survivor, that's just the title. I think it just tells you really like, it's more about like, hey, can we just get through these dark times, as it were? So, and what are you willing to sacrifice to make that happen? And so, which is, I think, a really intrinsically a fascinating question with character, and then the music very much plays towards that, and towards particularly the idea of with the Jedi, where Meren's back, and so the questions of what does family mean, and what are these things, and that's, I think, the music goes to the heart of the emotions of that, and that's really our job.
How much bigger would you say this new game is in comparison to Fallen Order? Is it a case of bigger, better, louder, would you say? That's a question for you both.
Yeah, I think it is exactly that. It's bigger, better, louder. It's development. It's you know, character development, story development. So it's really sort of pushing into a new realm, and musically and from story perspective.
Yeah, totally. I mean, particularly also with this game, you start at the beginning very much where Cal left off. So it isn't one of those things where games where we kick you back and you have to relearn how to force push and force pull and, you know, a bunch of stuff like that. Oh, you know, lots of games that you have to do that, and that's the only way you can do it and sort of have a thing. But really, we come back to Cal kind of at the power where the powers he left off at. So naturally, I think the combat's evolved, and really the sound, the music has evolved as well. And the other nice thing is we go through lots of new locations, particularly Kobo, the main planet, where this is very much functions as a sort of hub, and it's the place you keep coming back to and the sort of centerpiece of the story. But it has this feeling of the sort of the frontier and the Old West, and it's one of those ones where we wanted to bring in a very non-cliched way some flavor of that.
For me, the ferocity of the action music, I was listening to it, I was thinking, crikey, I was like, the orchestral players sound like they got one hell of a workout on this. I broke up my listening of the, because there is a lot of music, I had to break up my listening to it over like several evenings. And Stephen, you said that you did it in 29 days. But I mean, I suppose, is it a question of for you both about weighting the connotations of like the brassy section for like maybe the more heroism style with the strings for those more sweeping elegiac sections?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to sort of gauge each moment sort of individually and approach it that way and not give away too much too early. Really use sort of tactical approach to orchestration. But then from a technical perspective, like actually performing the music, I mean, That's where Stephen and I are, I'd say, two of the luckiest composers on the planet, because we had, like we said, basically 30 days of recording with the greatest musicians on the planet. And they are able to just turn the page and read that music as though they've been rehearsing it for months. Sounds about like what you hear on the album in the first take. So it's pretty impressive. I'm always blown away by it, even though I've done this many times in the past. But every time I hear it, I'm just like, wow, that's really incredible that they're able to do that so quickly. So we actually, in a way, knowing that they're capable of this, able to even stretch the boundaries a bit. And
yeah, we definitely.
We really went on this one.
This one, I think we absolutely sort of both sat down and were just like, okay, I wonder how hard you can push them. How hard can we write this? Because, I mean, some of the music in here is just insanely difficult in terms of its complexity for playing it. And so there's definitely, and actually we were joking, we were sort of like, one point we were trying to sort of put various sort of versions for live things together, and there's definitely pieces of music where we're like, this is never going to work in a live performance. It's just too difficult. It's just impossible. They're never going to be able to play it.
Where do you draw your inspirations from when writing music? Obviously this is a continuation, of course, of Cal's story from Fallen Order, but even going back to that, where, when you're coming together to write music for new characters within the Star Wars universe, where do you draw your inspirations from in terms of creating those themes and cues?
Yeah, I mean, I just try to draw my inspiration from the story itself, from the character's perspective on the story. That's really it, because I don't necessarily want to draw inspiration from any musical influences, because this story is unique,
yeah,
and deserves a unique score. So that was sort of our approach, I think, is really just to do what serves the story best, but also kind of push things forward and really kind of dig into our own personal musical aesthetic as well and try to really brand it in a sense that way.
You very much kind of go after various stylistic elements that I think we wanted. And one of the things we did on this score particularly was we sort of extended the palette as much as we could. And it was one of the ideas was to really look towards like lots of synth elements, lots of unusual instruments, including stuff that Gordy built in his studio over there, which I don't know if it's still there. I don't know if it's at the back of the room, but it's the water bottle instrument.
Oh, you can see it.
Yeah, you can see it at the back.
Water bottle. Tell us more.
And, tuned by the amount of water that's in each bottle. So it's actually a fully chromatic mallet instrument, and it makes a really weird kind of metallic ringy sound, like a chime with a lot of overtones. That got used quite a bit in the score. Then processed and then reamped in the studio at Abbey Road so that it would sound as though it was in the room with the orchestra. I mean, really, we just went for production value on everything, 100th degree.
We also, there's a hilarious one for all the Brits listening who know what blue tack is. We made use of probably the largest amount of blue tack has ever been used. Literally obscene amount. We got like 200 packs of it shipped to Abbey Road.
Wow.
And I kid you not, and literally like unwrapped and basically wrapped into a big sort of like tube, like tubular sort of like, well, basically long sausage essentially, like sort of the length of the piano strings. And we literally, with the kind permission of the, with a very, very nice, you know, 150,000 pounds, you know, Yamaha grand piano, we literally inserted it and pushed it into the strings, so all the strings were like damped down by it, so you get this sort of weird like clunky sort of tack piano-y sort of sound that has unusual resonances, and literally did a whole bunch of cues. We were recording with that, and it's a very strange sound, but that's all over some of the stuff at Kovo, just to give it the sense of like rustic brokenness to it. And yeah, and then literally I think they have enough blue tack at Abbey Road now to last them. Probably until probably the next millennium.
Part of my job was to take all that out of the packages while I'm recording all the music, and I'm like, it took a solid hour to build this long tube. It's a lot harder to work with than actually.
There's no in turnaround. I'll do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I shipped it there, and there was like literally sent all the instructions there because I got COVID, and so I couldn't actually go to that first batch of sessions first few days. And I was literally sitting there saying, okay, here's what you got to do. I'd be like, sorry, I don't know what the effects on your fingers is going to be, but it's going to be, anyway.
Work on Star Wars, they said. It'll be fun, they said.
Yeah. That technique of pushing something onto the piano strings, I might be stepping out of my boundaries here, not being a musician. Is that called, is that prepared piano? Is that technically exactly the right term for that?
Correct.
Okay.
It's just prepared in a way that I think definitely people have done little bits of blue tack. Actually, one of the players, he saw the part before the session. The copyist had sent him a thing saying, hey, by the way, there's this thing in your part you should probably see. And so he arrived at the session and sort of said, he had this tiny little thing, and we were like, no, that's not what we're thinking. You need like that, but 100 times as much blue tack as he did. He put it together, and he was really proud. There's a great picture also of Gordian.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's actually a picture.
Comparing sizes, shall we say.
Yeah. Blue tack sausages.
Blue tack sausages. We're here. How did we get to blue tack sausages?
Oh,
talking about the greatest franchise in pop culture. Amazing. See, even Star Wars is not above blue tack. Blue tack is a British institution. Speaking of, actually, and this leads perfectly onto my question about, I was going to ask about some of the more hilarious experiences you had along this journey. I guess that's at least two of them there. But some of the crazy things that have happened on this journey, not necessarily just with Survivor, but with Fallen Order as well, working together. Tell us about some of the good times and crazy times that you've shared on this journey together.
Well, they're all good times, I'll say that. You know, there were never bad times, because what a privilege. But yes, I would call that probably the funniest moment in the recording this particular score.
But it's also as they brought it out to the studio, like they sort of walked out with this, like, literally, I mean, it's like the thickness of a baseball bat and the length of a piano, and they're sort of walking out with this thing into orchestra. You can just see the whole orchestra being like, what the hell are they doing? What is that? And it's like, and so that was kind of entertaining, and that was a good one. But we've had some good times. I mean, Gordy and I have a thing where, like, on a bunch of the sessions we've done together, we'll always try and find a good bar somewhere and polish off, you know, a good quantity of a nice bottle of bourbon somewhere pre-sessions. We've had great times with it.
Yeah,
it's funny you mention that, because I think I read an anecdote from John Williams, you know, the kind of Eminence grease hanging over the franchise. I'm sure he said something about, like, there was a session, it might have been Star Wars, it might have been another film, where during lunchtime, it's recording in the UK, they would just go out and just have a few drinks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. That used to
be a bar at Abbey Road, so yeah. You know, you just go to the bar on your breaks, essentially.
Yeah. I remember it wasn't this project, but I remember the very first session I ever did, because they've gotten much better now, shall we say.
Yeah, yeah.
There are rules now, apparently, right? sort of informal rules, but the very first session I ever sat on, I walked in to see a trombone player with three pints lined up in front of him at the beginning of the session. It was like 6 o'clock in the evening, and you could see it, and the tuning got steadily worse during the session.
Yeah. I mean, it's a trombone player thing, to be honest. You know, the low brass are always...
Yeah. It could almost be passed away as an experiment. Simon, no, it's just going down. It's just going down. Well, I was going to, I mean, for me, what I really, that when you guys said about it, you find that sort of contemporaneous sound, that experimental sound that locates it as a score for the modern day, while it also does a magnificent job of honouring those idioms, those musical idioms that have defined Star Wars, because it is one, it's, I suppose it's inescapable, isn't it, really, that there is, you know, that John Williams did such a extraordinary thing in the 70s of taking orchestral music in that new direction, and you're both of you are kind of working inside that sandbox and outside that sandbox simultaneously. Would that be right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, you know, the way we sort of approached it, because there's a couple ways you could come at this thing. You could say, well, it's Star Wars, it needs to sound like John Williams, let's do like sort of a pastiche kind of thing. That was definitely not what we wanted to do at all. I mean, this is a new story, it's new characters, it's a story told in a different era. It needed a very original bespoke score. So rather than take that approach, we more took the approach of, what was John Williams thinking when he scored the first Star Wars? What were his influences? So looking back to, you know, symphonic music as an inspiration, you know, rather than looking to Star Wars music specifically as an inspiration, we took inspiration from classical composers that we both love, or just symphonic approaches to writing music. But how can we take that same approach and sort of put our own spin on it, bring it into present day in a sense, you know, with its production value? So rather than, you know, do the John Williams thing, we did our thing the way John Williams would have done it, I think, was sort of the goal.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, they're just, it's, I think it goes to ethos, and it's one of those things where you don't, one of the best ways to sort of honor it is to really look at what the influences were. And this one, I think we looked actually a long way out of the box of anything to do with Star Wars, really. And I mean, then one of the things that we really didn't do was also put a ton of temp music in the game of like John Williams stuff, and almost for basically nothing. And there really wasn't very much temp music in the game at all, in terms of stuff that was trying to sort of figure out what the tone is. And what we did a lot of was listen through classical repertoire and things like that, and to try and sort of find places that where the franchise hadn't been before, and sounds that might be interesting and vocabularies that might be interesting. So that was very much the approach. I mean, it was and thinking very out of the box in terms of the sound palette. So there's a lot of there's very little actual use of the John Williams themes in this one. Just a little bit, couple of places, but you know, maybe you hit the Force theme twice in the whole game.
That's right.
Two or three times in the whole game. But that's the idea, because this is not the ascendancy of the Jedi. Jedi are done at this point, you know, yeah. As far as anyone's in the galaxy is concerned. And so with that, I think that's what's really interesting about it, is saying like, okay, and Gordy wrote this one theme, which I, you know, I'll self-censor in case we've got a probably family-friendly show. So we have to, I called it, it's the Imperial You theme, basically, because it's like the Empire are here to stay. There's nothing you can do about it. And so yeah. He wrote this theme at the beginning of the game that is just it absolutely says that. It's like musically, it's like the Empire of One. Have a nice day.
Love that.
Yeah, I mean, and actually writing that theme was particularly fun, because sort of took a couple approaches. You know, I did look at like themes that I felt worked really well at sort of getting across this sense of impending doom, you know, something that is completely out of your control. They've already won. There's nothing you can do. You know, look at something like Jaws. I mean, it's such a simple little thing, but it's so effective, you know. Yeah. So like, is there something we can do that's as effective and as sort of simple, but still fits in the Star Wars canon in a way? So the idea, initially the idea was like, well, a heartbeat, you know, that's just that impending sense of like, it's never stopping, this pounding heartbeat. And, you know, I sort of translated that into more symphonic language and ended up sort of tracing the outline of like the heartbeat sinus rhythm. And so the melody itself actually kind of follows this shape of sinus rhythm. And also for the music nerds out there, it actually completes a full 12-tone row cycle before it comes back to itself. So it's, you know, Because I also kind of firmly believe that for something to be memorable, it doesn't necessarily have to be singable. Yeah. It just has to have a very memorable shape. And so proving that out. And I think it works.
Yeah, it's a sort of tune. It goes through every key and every note. Well, it goes through every note of the 12-tone scale. And it's very much a 12-tone kind of thing. But it's very much sort of like, we dominate everything here. There's no escaping from it kind of thing. And that recurs back throughout the score of this thing of like, you know, sort of it doesn't matter how many stormtroopers you take out. You're still puny, tiny, and irrelevant. And I think that's the thing of like juxtaposing those two things of like the sort of optimism of Cal, which is being very tested. And then that just sort of sense of like, you've lost, this is oppression. And very early on in one of the very first cinematics, a character says to Cal, like, why are you even bothering? Essentially, like this is just a waste of time. And that's, I think, one of the really interesting questions the game asks, which often, you know, Star Wars is often very sort of like, you know, although maybe not so much recently, but the, you know, the main thing is always about like, you've got to keep going. And like this one, it really says like, really? And that's, I think, a really interesting question to ask within the franchise. It's sort of the fundamental core of it, and then the idea of family as well, and this thing of saying like, are there things that the Jedi got wrong? Are the Jedi wrong about like being sort of this celibate order that pursues love and eschews so many things? You're like, this is a really interesting question to ask within the context of a Star Wars story and what that means. And, you know, I don't think very much it answers it. I don't think it goes one way or the other. It very much leaves it up to the player to decide.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, back on the point of like making something memorable and how you approach that, I will admit going into this, writing this theme, I was nervous that it would not be able to be a hook, something that people really grabbed onto and remembered, but you know, because it is sort of angular and atonal in a sense. Yeah. But funny, after the very first 3-hour session at Abbey Road, I'm walking to the little cantina to get some food, and the musicians are just walking up and down the hallway humming it. So it's really fascinating to me that it did catch on, and I think it just has a lot to do with like a very recognizable shape, a shape that we all sort of know and can see, you know, in our minds here. So it kind of does work.
It must be a tremendous amount of fun to be able to write music for a character, though, that has that much faith in himself, I guess, you know, like one guy against an entire galaxy. That must open up a wealth of possibilities to write for musically, right?
Totally. I mean, especially I think actually with and what's interesting about this game is we have a great new character played by Nasher Dalal called Bode, who's a very sort of classical, sort of almost like somewhat Indiana Jonesy sort of good guy, and is great. And so that was one of the, I think, the nice things is in this game you have that to go with Cal, and you also have, you know, once you get back to meet Merrin again, and this sense of There's obviously been some sort of ructions in the 3 years since Fallen Order, but this kind of feeling of like there's a bit of almost like in the game a little bit of like getting the band together again kind of feeling that sort of in the early parts of the game, which I think is really nice. And so that sort of gives you a new window into it, and then the story develops from there. So I think that was one of the things where it sort of you start to see Cal in a new light. You start to see him as someone who's sort of going, okay, well, I'm not gonna just, you know, knock the entire empire down on my own. I've got to be smarter about this, and I've got to like work with other people and figure out things if I'm gonna have any chance of doing any damage at all and putting a dent in this massive sort of behemoth of an evil entity. So yeah, I think that's really interesting. It's like and that musically, I think very much that was somewhere where Bode has a new theme and has very much is a huge part of it in terms of, you know, as a sidekick to Cal. So.
And then, of course, the further development of themes from Fallen Order, Cal's theme, you know, I would say,
grew Seer's up. Theme as well.
Seer's theme as well. Seer's theme grew up. Merrin's theme is much more prominent in this game than it even was in the first game. I mean, it was almost just a small motif that you would hear occasionally in Fallen Order, but now it's really sort of developed and become its own thing. And so it's fun to play with those things that Steven and I were able to come up with in the first game and really kind of stretch them and develop them a bit, age them with the story.
I think it's a testament to the effectiveness and the power of the music that I listened to it out of context, not having played the game, and I got a sense of narrative development through it. And particularly in the final third when it really escalates. And Cal's incipient heroism, his theme, I think for me, seemed to become more prominent in the final act of the game, which I imagine is where you put all the cards on the table, right? And good versus evil really does do battle kind of in the final stages of the album, which I'm assuming obviously pertains to the final stages of the game. Is that the journey that you want people to take on?
Very much so. And very much in the sense of that you get to the end of the game, which no one, I mean, literally, I've read a few people on Reddit having theories about what things are going to happen and something like that. No one's got even close to the first story that when I saw it was just like, it's the last 2 hours are just like, I'm mind-blowing. I mean, certainly one of the best sort of sections of a story in any Star Wars thing that I've ever seen. And and obviously I'm very biased, but I mean, it is just like, it goes places where I don't think anyone will think it's going to go. And musically, I think that was one of the things. It's, there is that battle of good and evil, but it's, you know, there's also the battle in the mind as well. And it's like, and so very much without saying too much, questions are asked of everybody, and it's a very, very difficult. I mean, it definitely, it's not something where, you know, it's not cuddly. This is definitely Empire Strikes Back.
Oh.
Absolutely, 1,000%.
It's very grown up, I would say.
Yeah.
Internal struggles, and like Stephen said, I mean, it's all of that. So it's very mature in a way, you know. And putting the album together, I mean, you know, like we said, there's 8+ hours of music that we wrote for the game. The album itself is close to 4 hours of music, so that was even a difficult task. How do you sort of curate an album that cuts out half of the music that you wrote, but still tells a story? So that was, you know, that was actually quite
It should be spoiler free as well. We should mention it. We've been very careful on the title.
Yes.
And I think also, and I've just come up this with Star Trek as well, where like being very careful with what things we use and where for exactly how things are going to go down. It's definitely a listening experience that dropping it right, you know, because last time it was really interesting is we dropped the soundtrack a long time after the game came out. And this one we're dropping day and date. So, and it's very much, I think if someone's listening through, you might get some ideas, but definitely won't be spoiled. And like when people see, I think that the last hour there's going to be on depending on how quickly people get to it. So I'm assuming by about the 20, sometime on the 29th, if someone's played all night, people will start going, oh my God. It's pretty mind blowing. So that'll be fun to see.
I'm really looking forward to spending that weekend just playing this game. I remember with Fallen Order, I had great privilege of coming to meet you guys when you were recording Fallen Order at Abbey Road, and we hung out for a while, and it was awesome to watch you work. And then I just remember being completely fascinated by the opening of Fallen Order and how just mind... I don't think anybody was prepared for how mind-blowingly but exciting, but also quite stressful the opening of that game is, you know, narratively speaking as well. And then just to get into that, it just... I anticipate, or how much do you anticipate, or how many, should I say, how many fans are you anticipating going to just write off the weekend of the 28th? Now that you've seen
quite a few of them are going to write that weekend off.
and because of the length of the game, depending on how much you like side quests as well, we might have to apologize to some employers on Monday.
Lots of people calling in sick.
Longer. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah. Apologies, but hey, it's worth it. And it'll be the good bit, and they'll come in energized as well. So.
You mentioned the Abbey Road setup. What is it specifically about Abbey Road that works for this kind of musical narrative storytelling, do you think?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I mean, Abbey Road has something very magical that it brings to a recording. I mean, it has its own sort of shimmer that it puts on everything. With this score, we actually recorded at Abbey Road, but we also recorded at Air Studios in London as well. Both of those rooms are very magical, but really... Rooms aside, what makes both of those places magical, in my opinion, is the musicians you put in the room. And the top musicians in London are just stellar. And so they bring things to life in a way that's just unimaginable. And both of those rooms sort of like just give it life. So they were the obvious choices for us.
I think there are also places where there's so much has been done in both, and particularly in Abbey One. I mean, you know, Edward Elgar conducted the first recording in there, so you can't really beat that. It's like, and it's also the what's really interesting about them, I think, is it's a psychology thing, and I can compare it actually, funny enough, actually to a recent Trek thing we had where I went on set, and it's funny how psychology affects things, and ultimately it's just a room. It's a room that sounds very nice, and you know, players, but the players are just playing in an orchestra, and like they've done their entire lives. But what's really interesting about those spaces, we had something recently on Star Trek where we had a particular set, and everyone, you know, usually on set is like between takes, everyone's like noise and stuffing moved around something. But this particular set, and I won't spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen that, is that there's a very special set on our last episode, and everyone was just walking around reverentially, you know, and there was silence between takes. They didn't even have to ring the bell to shut everyone up so they could actually start rolling. And it's the same thing. It's like Abbey Road has that thing. You just go in there, and because of what's happened in there, and everyone knows it, everyone brings their A game, and it's like you wouldn't really want to do anything else. And it doesn't go away after thousands of times of going there now. It never stops. So I think that's one of the things. It's a group psychology thing that just affects everybody, and you feel it in the, you know, it's amazing.
It's yeah. almost like people rise to the history of the room in a
Absolutely.
Way.
Yeah.
I feel
yeah.
it.
Like if these walls could talk. You
yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
Well, that was the documentary, wasn't it? Either yeah. these walls could sing. That was the Mary McCartney's yeah. documentary. I mean, but it's kind of true. It does have true. That effect. It's like playing a great instrument. It's like
been in that room.
So. You just know. You just know. So it's amazing.
I always feel like it's funny. Whenever I've the great privilege of being invited to watch any of you guys work. And watch your process. I always do this thing where I tell this story a lot, but I love it. I walk up to the gate and there's the big sign that says it's not for public access, and it's not for kind of if you're a tourist, go the other way next door, and all that kind of stuff that you see on the gate. And even though I've been invited, because of its majesty, I always walk up and go, oh, hang on a minute, I'm supposed to be here, and I walk past the sign and I go in, right? But do you guys ever get that as well? You can't, because it's so regal, because it's so magical.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I get sort of almost starstruck by a building, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I've gotten to the point where I really actually really enjoy that moment now. Like, sort of, there's always, in front of Abbey Road, there's always Beatles fans and people that are taking pictures of the studio and writing on the wall in front of it and that kind of thing. And I sort of now enjoy knowing that I have this privilege to walk into that space without anyone even asking who I am. You know, it's like I just walk through the gate and kind of smile at everyone standing there taking photos and just walk in. Like I get to be a rock star for about, you know, 20 seconds.
You guys are working in the Star Wars sandpit. You're forever rock stars. I mean, working on Star Wars means that you are cemented in the canon, in the pop culture, as far as I'm concerned. But it's interesting because recently, me and John, we spoke to Brian Tyler about his score for Super Mario, and we talked about the development of video game music, which has been really meteoric and extraordinary. I mean, I remember Tomb Raider having that really immersive sampled classical sound, and then you got Medal of Honor, and you've gone like God of War and, you know, Assassin's Creed and everything. I wondered, like, for you guys, were there any kind of formative video game soundtrack experiences that you remember standing out as like moving the medium forward?
Final Fantasy has some what I consider.
Yes. Yes.
I always look to that as sort of a pinnacle of sort of breaking new ground for games to have music of that quality. And there's been so many, and, you know, hearing the evolution of it over time is another thing too, because even some of those games even started out with maybe, you know, not a live orchestra score, but as they evolved, that music then became reimagined for a live orchestra and sort of grew up and developed in that way. So, yeah, I mean, there's so many really great scores in games. It's hard to turn a blind eye to it at this point. I think game music is very mature and here to stay.
Yeah, very much so. And I think also there's a lot of the early Nintendo stuff, I think, was on the money quicker than anybody, really, in terms of, I mean, even down to some of the stuff on the Game Boy was, you know, kind of figured out that you could really make so much more out of this experience, even when you had like very limited resources. And then, you know, I think there's various other franchises have just been very influential. I mean, certainly Tomb Raider, 1998 or 97, 98 was the first one I really noticed, like, hey, that had a massive score. That Pete Cobbin, actually had lunch with him the other day, and he was chatting about recording it. And he was just like, he was like, I have no idea what we're even doing here. But, and literally all the musicians were like, a video game? Isn't that what? And, you know, that's really culminated in recently, and obviously with the, we now have a Grammy category, which has taken a good part of 30, 40 years to get it. But it's but what's really funny about it is, if you sit people down from the music industry and say, they very much have in the past it was like film scores, TV, and game composers were somewhere down, below the table, lower than the lowest of the low. And now it's really funny, and particularly with the pandemic, where obviously film and TV shut down for a long time, but games exploded. We couldn't make them fast enough. I think it's really interesting that we now have this equation where we're looking at games as really being the sort of foremost kind of place to really explore musically, and I think that's only going to continue, because gaming is something like nine times the size of film and TV combined. Which is insane. But that's, there you go.
Do you guys just take films on now for a bit of a break?
A very linear break where you know where the beginning and the end is, and it doesn't change.
A break because it's less than 2 hours of music, most likely.
I mean, it's actually a very funny point, actually. I think it's what's really interesting is, and where Gordy and I have like sort of chatted about this over the years as well, is these things are also getting so big where it used to be very in vogue to be like, oh, right, we're going to hire this Hollywood composer to score this game and write it. But you're getting to the point where, unless someone actually really does know at least some of the nuts and bolts about how games are built, they're just getting so complicated and so big that you have to be able to have a look at this sort of Sistine Chapel-esque 30-hour, kind of massive campaign and be able to pace yourself and be able to sort of figure out how where things go. And so that's part of the fun of that, is like the I think there's the where this industry is going to go is going to be very, it's going to be a big challenge for everybody just to sort of keep up with the scope of these things. But on the flip side, this incredible opportunity to be able to say, like, it's literally saying to almost, we're almost at the point with the amount of music where you're looking at like the trilogy of one of the Star Wars movies and say, like, yeah, what happens to, like, what would John Williams do with just the whole trilogy if he was doing the whole trilogy in one go? Which is a really interesting question, and that's the scale of these things. And
that's a good point. Yeah, it's a very good point, because I'm speaking to composer friends of mine that primarily work in film, and I can remember getting this question or this comment. It must be really nice to have so long to work on a score, like a whole year. And I'm like, well, there's 10 hours of music in this game, so it's like having a whole year to score, an entire trilogy plus a reboot.
It's
still as much work. Trust me, it's just longer schedules, but much more music and a lot more technical specs to consider. There's quite a bit to it.
It is funny, and it's also, one of the most frequent questions we get asked by lots of people in terms of, not just even when we're talking about our work, but just by people generally in the industry, like, oh, how is it different scoring from a film and TV to scoring a game? And the answer is rapidly becoming, it's way harder. Way harder.
We both it's work like, in film and TV as well. It's harder, I can tell.
And it's also with the development of these kinds of games, is like you end up with, they might have whole sections that they'll build, prototype out and then cut. And it's one of those things of being able, you're starting to having to be able to musically pivot, because you have to start so early to be able to get through the quantity of it, that you have to, this ability to pivot very, very quickly and be like, okay, well, this isn't working. Or and lots of music that's great, lovely bit of music, but doesn't work for the context, or the context just changes. Usually with a film, unless something's gone very, very wrong in production, when that happens, don't really get, like, unless you get reshoots or something like that, you don't suddenly, like, a whole extra sequence doesn't just appear, or that the whole ending of the game of a film changed, they'd have to actually go and shoot it. But that happens in games, like whole sections can be completely changed in tone, so you could have an area walking through which has a ton of combat, and then one day you come back and they've taken it all out, and it's like a stealthy sort of get through this section, but that's changed, and the music has to go with that. So they're becoming increasingly complicated in a really wonderful way. And that's actually been a lot of fun.
No, I agree. I mean, to take a section out of a game, which happens often, say that to a composer, it's literally the equivalent of sometimes of like, oh, we just removed an entire feature film's worth of music. We're going to have to redo or rethink. So that's why the schedule's a little longer, but they're just as, if not more, difficult sort of to handle in that sense from a production perspective and a composing perspective.
Yeah, I don't know if this is an accurate observation, but it almost sounds like then that scoring a video game can almost be like scoring a film that doesn't have a locked cut, because obviously that phrase I've heard a lot when a film isn't locked down and it's kind of like off, like I think like James Horner with Aliens or something, it's like, for goodness sake, you know, you need the whole thing kind of like there, but it requires you to be flexible, right? It requires you to, like you say, pivot.
What was it Tyler Bates called it, putting the pants on the running man?
This is kind of where the man is running, and we know that he's going to be running almost all the way until the very, very end of the production, long after we finish the music. And so, and also, there might be more than one guy. you might not even be sure which guy you had to even put the pants on. So it's very much a good analogy. It's like that, and it requires this sort of ability to just be okay with something hitting the cutting room floor, right? Because it does quite frequently, and not by virtue of anything other than something changed, and you have to like figure out a new approach to something, or the way we get around a particular corner, or literally not having the be able to see what something even looks like. You're seeing just a very, very rough grayscale build of kind of like a mesh, just you live with no textures in it at all. And sort of having to be like, okay, imagine that this is a really dark, really evocative landscape. It looks just like some Play-Doh kind of figures and cardboard. Yeah, blue tack, literally. Yeah. You know, it's that equivalent. And it's almost like the actors who, I have such admiration for them who work when they're working on green screen, because they can't see a thing, or they're doing the PCAP sessions and they're just literally in what's the equivalent of roughly like a school gymnasium, you know, right, trying to imagine these things and give performances with no help whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's not uncommon, not on this game specifically, but on other games I've worked on, to score cinematics that are just literally footage of mocap sessions. No graphics whatsoever. You're just seeing actors in a suit with a bunch of ping pong balls stuck all over them, and you're scoring that. So it takes a lot of sort of suspending disbelief, imagination, you know, foresight of what it will be later.
It reminds me a lot of back on the Narnia films when I was working on those with Harry Gregson Williams. We had, you know, Aslan for the longest time was just a tennis ball on a stick. And, you know, he was eventually replaced, but it was literally a tennis ball on a stick with somebody else, not even Liam Neeson, somebody else reading his dialogue in a very monotone voice. You know, like, okay, great, that's really inspiring. What am I supposed to? And they're like, insert lion here. Basically that.
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine Liam Neeson's tones, but it's not quite working at the moment. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Before we go, guys, I just wanted to just quickly, I did want to mention the fact that I understand that you're going on tour with this as well. You're taking this music to concert. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, I think. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I think so.
It's been announced.
So there we go. So the Game Awards is that we all know and love, usually happens in December, has decided to put on a concert at the Hollywood Bowl this year, featuring decades worth of the considered greatest music in video games. So we have a little segment on there as well. So we have a concert suite that we put together. I won't give too many details on what will be in that concert suite, but I think it'll be a lot of fun for the audience. So we're excited about that.
I was going to say, we'll be there spiritually from the UK.
I'm thinking of flying there already. Just
in 25th. That's
the it's a day before my birthday. I might have to. He's got to make it now.
you got to do it. I was going to ask actually, Gordy, just before we wrap up, look, were you at the Star Wars celebration recently in London?
Yeah,
did I see that you Instagrammed about that? Like,
Both Stephen and I were there for this year, and you know, I had the privilege of stepping onto this massive stage following up Ewan McGregor of all things, so that wasn't nerve-wracking at all. Talking a bit about my history of working on the franchise since the Old Republic, because I've been working on a lot of the games over the years, Old Republic and the Battlefront series, Squadrons and so on. I got to experience that, and it was a lot of fun, and it's cool to sort of play to that crowd in person. Sea of lightsabers, you know, lighting up as you walk onto a stage is not a bad day.
So. I mean, that's remarkable that a Star Wars soundtrack, that's how much it's permeated the consciousness in it. You can now bring that to an audience, and not only is there an acceptance of it, there's an expectation that that will now happen, that that is such a part of the fabric of the fandom. And it must be so gratifying for both of you to be able to see that.
It is, very much so. You know, I mean, and there's a generation of folks that play games, you know, younger generation, where I think a lot of their exposure, their introduction to Star Wars was actually through the games. So in a way, as iconic as, you know, and as important as John Williams' scores were for me with my musical development, I think a lot of people are hearing the scores for games, and that's sort of their inspiration, even more so than films these days. It's such a huge sort of industry and has such a giant fan base, Star Wars even aside, I mean, just gaming in general. So it's actually really kind of cool to think that.
We should both be very, very proud. It's an amazing score. The first, I loved Fallen Order. I listened to it over and over and over. I'm glad they finally released it, because it was the only chance we had to listen to it was in the game. But now it's out. And of course, Star Wars Jedi Survivor is available on all your favorite gaming platforms. You're probably playing it already. Hopefully you're listening to this before you play it, maybe. But also the album is out. 44 tracks, guys, I think, isn't it? Is it 44 tracks? Yep. Yeah, amazing. Get that in your collection. Absolutely. Gordy, Stephen, it's been an incredible pleasure to speak with you both again. Thank you so much for your time. Good luck with what I hope will be a great success with this game, as it was before. And wishing you all the best, guys. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Now or never.
Seems our destinies are intertwined.
But I can tell you this. If there is any hope of surviving, we must stand against the darkness.
Gordy Hab and Stephen Barton there, talking about their work on Star Wars Jedi Survivor and Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order. Very, very interesting chat. I really, really enjoyed that. Sean, how are you feeling now listening back to that?
Oh, ecstatic. I mean, weren't they brilliant? Just really, really passionate about the franchise and about asserting their own musical voice on the game and the instrumentation that they use, the themes that they use. I mean, we could have talked to them about that all evening. And there are, like I said at the top of the episode, there are 4 hours worth of music. So, and we only spent an hour talking about it. So, yeah, but what an hour it was. Fantastic.
Yes, absolutely. No, but it's always a great privilege to. I've spoken to Gordy a number of times now, and it's always great fun with him. And as I said, as I mentioned in the interview, I was able to go to Abbey Road and actually watch them at work, and it was incredibly fascinating to watch them do that. But if you want to hear the score, you can do so right now. The score album is out, all 4 glorious hours of it by Gordy and Stephen. It's out now via Disney Music. That's on all streaming platforms, all music streaming platforms, but also available to download now if you would like that. I think you should get it because it's awesome. The game is, of course, available now on PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X, I believe, and maybe one or two other platforms, but those are the 2 main ones. You can play that this weekend. Why not get on that? And if you've not played it yet, it is the middle part. Their Empire Strikes Back, as they like to call it. So by all means, grab the first game, Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order, which is also available now on all gaming platforms. Thank you very, very, very much to Sabrina on Gordy's management team for helping us with this. Sabrina Hutchison, we love you very dearly, and thank you for your assistance with this. Also, all our friends at White Bear PR as well, and Disney Music for helping us bring this episode together. Also, I should probably mention that Star Wars Return of the Jedi is also in cinemas again at the moment. At time of recording, Star Wars Return of the Jedi has returned to cinemas for its 40th anniversary. My word, it's 40 years old. But yeah, do go and check that out in cinemas. And also a big thank you for all our support from my side. Sean, I know there's probably one or two people you want to thank, we'll get to in a second, but I do want to thank the View Cinema here, where I record my end of the podcast here in Gunwolf Keys, because they've been incredibly great with making sure I was up to speed on everything Star Wars related for that. You can find your nearest View Cinema at myview.com. Sean, anyone you'd like to thank? That could be cinemas, game developers, your mum, anyone. Would you like to thank anyone?
Well, I'll always thank my parents for supporting me, so because my parents always take an interest in these interviews, so thanks, Mum and Dad. More specifically, yeah, thanks to Sabrina and guys at White Bear PR, just to reiterate what you said, John, and the guys at Disney as well, for helping to set this up, because it was a real privilege being able to talk to Gordy and Stephen about this and to get stuck into this. So yeah, anyone listening to this interview, please drop us comments online. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, please do. And if you're seeing this on social media, by all means, retweet, like, share, do all that wonderful stuff. At Need a Bigger Pod is the current home of Scoreheads on socials. I'm also at John Brown TV, J-O-N, at John Brown TV on all social media. Sean, you are?
At Sean022 on Twitter and at Sean Film Writer on Instagram.
Thank you very much, sir. And we've got more exciting episodes coming up for you. I say regular fix because we are a regular fix at the moment. We are very carefully working on making sure we're your weekly fix. That's coming right up in the next couple of weeks, at the time of recording, of course. So we're looking forward to being your weekly fix, because we do have a number of guests for you. I'm just trying to think out loud. At the time of recording this, there were another five to come out. Four?
I think that's right. Yeah. I think you're right.
Very exciting. Incredibly exciting. We've got a wealth of really talented people to bring conversations to you with those folks, and we've recorded them as well, so they're all to come, including a very huge film which we'll talk about on another episode. Sean, thanks very much. Thank you again to you at home for listening. We really appreciate it, and yeah, take care.